You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. Thanks so much to the several thousand of you guys that have been tuning in for every episode in our first five episodes here. And I'm glad to be talking back with you this weekend with another guest, Lauren Chen. She is a host on Blaze TV of Pseudo Intellectual. You can find her on YouTube, and she's also a contributing writer for EV Magazine. Lauren, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you, you know, because I've been following your YouTube work for a long time, and we have some of the same interest areas. And I've done a lot of writing about kind of political correctness and identity politics run amok. So maybe to start us off, you could just tell us a little bit about your work covering these issues. And have you perceived an increase in kind of the spread of woke extreme ideology beyond the borders of college campuses into mainstream life?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, probably like you, I've been talking about this stuff for years and years and years. And I remember, you know, 4 years ago when I was talking about political correctness and these identity politics issues, I had a lot of people say this is just a couple of crazies on the internet, on Tumblr, ignore them. This doesn't affect the real world. Well, fast forward 4 years, and now we see identity politics playing a huge part in mainstream elections, right? And regular politics. This isn't just limited to college campuses and Tumblr anymore. We see this in, you know, our popular entertainment media. We see this in, I mean, speeches given by presidential nominees and things like that. So it's definitely picked up, and it's concerning, especially when you're on social media. It seems like, I mean, that's a kind of a self-selected pool of people.
Oh, yeah.
It seems like the people who are in favor of it far outnumber the people who are against it. So I think it's more of an issue now than ever. And it's, I mean, you know, I try to stay positive as much as I can, but I just hope that, you know, people like you and your audience and people who are interested in combating these ideas, I hope we just don't end up getting drowned out.
Right. Well, the good thing is, I think there's an audience who's really interested in hearing these ideas and these narratives rebutted. But I think maybe we can go through the issues one by one. But in terms of the media, I know you do a lot of content where it's some crazy Vox article or some crazy Vice article, but that stuff has really started to bleed into the mainstream, don't you think? I mean, I come at this from the perspective of a conservative journalist, but I'm still a journalist. So I believe in like free press. I believe in like traditional journalistic values. Yet I find it so concerning when you have things like unions from the New York Times speaking out, trying to get their conservative colleagues censored, or when they fired opinion editors at the New York Times for daring to run an op-ed by a Republican senator. And I guess, what's your vantage point on kind of the U.S. media and how the extremism has creeped in over the last few years?
Well, I don't think this is an issue exclusive to the US media. We do stories covering what's happening in the UK as well and Canada. And I think this is kind of like a global issue, frankly. The media bias has gotten out of control. And, you know, I'm someone who believes that no matter who you are, as much as you may try to be impartial, you're probably going to have at least some sort of, I mean, inherent slant or spin that you may not be able to control. And I think that's normal. And that's just part of being a human being. But what we see now with journalists with quote marks is that there's no longer even the attempt at impartiality or fairness, right? We see that a lot of these journalistic publications, they've largely become activist platforms for people who are very, very obviously trying to push one narrative over the other. And frankly, it is a kind of progressive left-wing narrative that's winning out at publications like the Washington Post, New York Times, these, I guess, news outlets that at one point, especially when I was a student, I had considered, you know, paradigms of impartiality, and places like CNN seem to be getting more and more biased by the week, it seems. So, you know, I do a lot of crazy news stories where I'll look at what places like Salon or Jezebel or Vox, like you mentioned, are saying, and it's fun to poke and laugh at that. But I find more and more it's hard to tell the difference between, you know, places like Vice and places like CNN, because I think more and more these quote journalists, they're kind of leaning onto the whole opinion piece, onto the more, I mean, you have people like Jim Acosta who are pretty much,
right,
they're pundits masquerading as journalists. And don't get me wrong, I consider myself more of a commentator and pundit than a journalist. And it's fine if Jim Acosta wants to do that, but don't pretend to be unbiased. Don't pretend as if you are trying to present both sides fairly, because you're just not. And I think more people are also starting to realize that.
I agree with you. And I think that's the problem, because there's no such thing as unbiased news or an unbiased journalism. The problem is that people don't own the bias, and people don't, they kind of cosplay as objective reporters while clearly pushing an activist of intervention and even blatantly skewing the facts. I mean, the thing that comes to mind for me is the CNN reporter who is standing in front of a burning building and saying fiery but mostly peaceful BLM protests. Like, you can just call it a riot when you're standing in front of burning buildings. It's okay to call an apple, as they would say. I guess maybe I'll ask you this, because you've got an interesting perspective as somebody with kind of feet in both of these worlds. What's the Canadian media like? How is it divided?
I mean, the Canadian, everything in Canada is more skewed left wing, right? We have a party here that's nominally called the Conservative Party, but if they were to go down to the States, they would be Democrats, right? I mean, not kind of far left Democrats, but they definitely wouldn't count as Republicans. The Overton window in places like Canada and the UK, you know, most of Europe, it's much, much further left than it is in the United States. So that's one thing. And when it comes to our media, one of the largest media outlets that we have in Canada is the CBC, which is state-funded propaganda, essentially. You know, it's funded by the government. The government that's currently in power keeps promising them bigger and bigger budgets. So predictably, their coverage of that administration has been very favorable. Go figure. And, you know, I think it's very, very disgusting that Canadian taxpayers right now are having to subsidize things like, you know, CBC has done reports on transgender children and things like that. At the BBC in the UK, it's a similar story. So it's just everything is further to the left here. If you think that media bias is bad in the United States, you haven't seen anything yet until you've seen the Canadian media.
Yeah, and I you make a good point about the difference between state-run media. Like, CNN might be bad, but at least I'm not forced to fund it,
right?
And that's the thing that I think the U.S. media system has over. I would never support any form of state-run media, even if it was going to be right-wing, right in my own values, because I don't believe in forcing people to pay for it. And also, I just think it's ridiculous to think that they could fairly, right? No one's ever objective, but you can be fair, fairly cover the people that are signing their checks. But so what do you think the solution is to media bias and to the kind of infiltration of left-wing radicalism? Is it to just create our own echo chambers, or to go fight in those institutions, or how do we deal with this problem?
It's a hard question, right? And I get people coming to me all the time, like, what news sources are unbiased? Who can I trust? And I have to say the answer is trust nobody. Because, you know, I watch a lot more Fox than I do MSNBC, but I definitely don't think that they are impartial or that they don't have their own agenda. And I think, you know, part of being a rational consumer of news is being able to ascertain the facts for yourself whenever possible. For instance, try to look at firsthand sources, right? Don't just take someone's word about what happened. Watch the actual footage for yourself. Read the actual statement for yourself, whatever it may be. So that's the first thing. And I think a lot of people may not like to hear that, because it takes more work to do your own research than to just kind of rely on someone else to summarize things for you. But we're in a situation right now where, I mean, if you want to make sure you have all the facts, you need to be proactive about it. And I mean, I think a lot about how at least journalism as a profession used to be maybe 50 years ago. And I mean, part of me does wonder, maybe there's not more bias nowadays. Maybe we're just more aware of the bias because we have things like social media where people are able to see things for themselves and discuss things that they weren't before, because the media used to have complete control over the public discourse. So, you know, I don't know if it's even possible to return to a golden standard of journalism that maybe didn't even exist in the first place. But I think, you know, by and large, it's going to take responsibility on everyone's part to just be more aware of the type of information you're consuming and take it upon yourself to make sure that you aren't in your own echo chamber, even if that means, you know, exposing yourself to some ideas and some people you might find unpleasant. The alternative is much worse.
Well, you're actually an interesting person to talk about this with, because I've worked in traditional media, and then I've also kind of dabbled in like YouTube and social media, and they're two different worlds, right? There's like old boomer media that still has a lot of influence, but is kind of fading. And then there's this whole other world that traditional media doesn't even know exists. Like YouTubers like you have, on some of your videos, you have a bigger reach than Fox News is 5 p.m. hour, right? Mm-hmm. But people in newsrooms don't, and this is an insult, don't know who you are, right? They don't know who Blair White is. They don't know who Steven Crowder is, because they just don't understand that this whole side of the world. So what do you think the upsides of kind of the social media and internet information revolution are? And then what are the biggest downsides?
Well, I think, and it's funny because some people think this is a downside, and I guess it depends on how you look at it. But I've heard people complain that, you know, when you start to get your news from YouTubers, anybody can be, you know, a source of information technically. And that's, it's a double-edged sword, right? Because, you know, on the one hand, I think we have seen the rise of, not that it's as big as a problem as the left likes to make it out to be, but, you know, there are extremists out there who have managed, because of the internet, to build their own audiences, right? And to connect themselves with people who share similar fringe ideas. And there is kind of like, you know, that snowball effect where they kind of feed off of each other. So that's
right.
That's
real.
Yeah, that's real. It's not as big of a problem as I think some people make it out to be, but I'm not going to pretend it doesn't exist. It does, you know. But on the other hand, I look at a lot of the mainstream media establishments, and I would not want those people gatekeeping who does and who does not get a platform, right? So I think, you know, the rise of a lot of dissident voices, a lot of people calling out the establishment, that wouldn't have been able to happen if we were completely reliant on traditional media, because traditional media is the establishment, right? So unless you have a more almost populist form of communication, you're not going to get those voices who are calling out the people in power. And I think that, you know, right now, people like Donald Trump, he wouldn't be in power if we were solely reliant on the establishment media.
Oh, yeah. I mean, his Twitter is the biggest tool to circumvent the media, right? Because he can get directly to people. And if he'd had to put everything through the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, he would not have gotten very far. Whether you consider that an upside or a downside, it, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder. But what do you think of, I know you're somebody who has a lot of following on the internet. I have a smaller one, but I've felt it too. There's an element of toxicity that's bred by the anonymous nature and the behind screens nature of all this stuff that I think has fueled partisanship and tribalism. And like, I try to use Twitter a lot less during the weekends to kind of preserve a sane life. So there's clearly some downsides here, right?
Yeah, you're right. And they have done studies, and people who use social media more are more likely to have things like anxiety and depression and all these terrible, terrible things that go along with it. So, you know, my job is largely dependent on social media, so I can't knock it too much. But I'm not going to say that overall it's this amazing thing with absolutely no downsides. I mean, Twitter is a cesspool. I think you and I both know that.
We both experienced that firsthand.
Yeah, for sure. But I think what's interesting is that I see a lot of people kind of blame Twitter as a platform for the state of political discourse. But I think that's unfair. What Twitter is simply a tool that's allowed people to communicate with each other. I think the downside of Twitter is that it's allowed people to be people. So I think we can blame things like Twitter and Facebook for toxicity, but at the end of the day, it's us, right? It's us people doing it to each other. And I don't think that we would necessarily be any better if we moved from Twitter to a different platform like Parler, because I mean, it's still the same people saying the same things.
Right.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the problem about this toxicity actually comes from echo chambers, like you mentioned before. I mean, I know firsthand that the most hateful kind of haters that I have are, I think, really the ones who don't know any conservatives in real life, are just gaining what they know about conservatives from places like Vice and Vox and Jezebel and things like that. And the opposite is true as well. For every MAGA boomer who complains about libtard destroying the country, right, they probably don't have a lot of liberal friends either.
Right.
I'm not sure how we start to break through those echo chambers, especially when a lot of them are based on things like maybe geography or profession and stuff like that. But it's a real problem.
Yeah, and part of what I'm hoping to do with this show is talk to people who are across, and you and I are similar on some of the issues and different on some that we'll talk about later, but I've been trying for weeks now actually to get a socialist to come on the show. Mm-hmm. I've reached out to several, I won't name names to shame them, but like, They won't. They won't do it. I have U.S. senators lined up to come on this show, but I can't get like a socialist journalist. They won't do it. And that's a little bit frustrating. But let me ask you this. Where are you on the issue of big tech censorship?
I think big tech censorship is probably the greatest threat to democracy worldwide. It's not just an American issue. It's a worldwide issue. A lot of countries in Europe, I mean, Canada, Australia, never mind. I mean, just South American countries, like pretty much every country that has internet access is using social media as a platform to talk about political issues. It is terrifying to me that these unelected, unaccountable technocrats have as much power as they do. And I know this is a contentious issue among everybody, but among conservatives as well, because a lot of conservatives, they look at people like myself who are speaking out against big tech censorship and they say, well, hang on, like, are you in favor of nationalizing? Do you want to regulate? Like, what's happening? Because I think they fear, like, what would happen if, for example, a Biden administration had control over big tech? Is that better than Mark Zuckerberg? And the conversation goes from there. And I think what people need to understand is that there is an alternative to, for example, nationalizing Twitter, and that is properly enforcing Section 230, what a lot of people like myself believe is a tool to hold social media accountable, is actually removing the protections that they already have. So right now, if I own like a regular website and I publish something that's slanderous or libelous, I forget, between the two, against somebody, I can be liable to be sued. Right. But the protections that right now places like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube have under Section 230 is that since they claim to just be platforms, they are, I guess, immune to any of the consequences what they're
right. It's a liability shield.
Right. Exactly. That isn't really what we're seeing right now, though. I mean, the whole pretense of Section 230 was that these sites were platforms, not publishers. But right now, what we are seeing is that places like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube are consciously curating content for their users, right? They are deciding what can and cannot stay up based on, editorial decisions, pretty much. They're promoting things that they like and suppressing things they don't like, again, based on editorial decisions. These are not things that a platform does. So I think if these companies want to behave like publishers, they should have all of the same liabilities and responsibilities that publishers do. I think they should be open to, any type of legal action that any other site would be liable to if they held hosted the type of content that they do. And this is not a form of necessarily regulating big tech. This is actually removing regulations that were put in place to protect big tech. This is just allowing big tech the same responsibilities as anyone else online. And, even as a conservative, I am not against consumer protections when it comes to things like, data mining and data privacy. Every other industry operates with some form of consumer protections, whether that's, retail or the restaurant industry. None of these apply to big tech. It's almost curious how long they've been able to go largely unregulated. And I think that's because they have so much power. So, I mean, none of this is to say we should, have this government agency of the internet to control what big tech companies do. It's literally just holding them accountable in the same way that any other business is.
So let's talk about this because we disagree on this. And maybe I'll just explain where I'm at. So we agree on the problem. I agree with everything you said about big tech censorship being a serious problem. It is alarming to have Twitter suppressing an election-related story by the New York Post about Hunter Biden banning people who tweet the link. That's really disturbing stuff. But I will say it wasn't really very effective. It had the Streisand effect of blowing up the story even more. But I agree with you on the problem.
The thing with the Streisand effect is that it only applies to people who are on social media and who were aware of the story in the first place. Most Americans are not avid Twitter users. So, I mean, it's really only the Streisand effect of people who are already engaged online politically, which is not most people.
But wasn't it all over cable news, wall to wall, Fox News all day, the Hunter Biden suppression of Twitter censored this Twitter? So I think it got out there. I really do.
I mean, yeah, but if you're only relying on like what Fox News and people who follow maybe James O'Keefe are able to see, I mean, at that point, you're just preaching to the choir, right? I mean, if people aren't able to organically share this information on their own platforms, then that is controlling information.
Yeah, we don't disagree on that.
yeah, imagine what would happen and what the outcry would be if you were on the phone with someone and you tried to verbally tell them a story and the phone company dropped your conversation. That is essentially what places like Twitter and Facebook are doing.
No, and we don't really disagree on this. Like, they should not be doing this. I think the Section 230 question is a problem for me. I don't support taking it away because essentially the concerns are twofold, right? One thing, if you repeal the Section 230 protections, then all of a sudden Twitter is liable for every piece of content that gets posted to it. YouTube is liable for, or potentially liable for every piece of content that gets posted to it. YouTube, which has, like, you probably know the statistics better than me, but like, 1 million hours of video uploaded a day or something crazy, has to basically pre-approve all this and run it through their legal team to make sure none of it's libel. So I think it would lead to more censorship if they were accountable all this content.
I think the miscommunication here is that I'm not in favor of completely getting rid of Section 230. I just don't think it should apply to companies like YouTube and Facebook, right? If there's another company that is completely playing by the rules and being an unbiased platform, I think they should have those protections. I don't think they should be liable for what other people are posting on their site. But I think the FCC needs to make a judgment call and say, look, clearly this section no longer applies to places like YouTube and Facebook because of this action. So they need to say that as long as YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter continue to participate in these types of behaviors, then they are not eligible to claim protections under Section 230. So it's not a question of saying remove the protection entirely for everybody, but it's for these specific sites who are clearly, especially if you take into account Trump's executive order on the issue, not holding up their end of the deal. They shouldn't be able to hide behind it. They shouldn't be able to have their cake and eat it too. Other companies, they can have those protections. And if Twitter and Facebook and YouTube change their tunes, which I hope they do, then they can have those protections, no problem. And I've heard people like, was it Tim Pool? I might be wrong on that. I've heard other people say, but isn't this going to lead to just more censorship? Or it could actually lead to Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook once again just being platforms, right? And I think actually even if it does lead to just more censorship, then I think at least more people would be aware that this problem would be happening and the market would have a greater desire for alternatives. So, I mean, either way, I'm happy with the outcome.
Okay. I mean, I'm glad we talked about that. I think the one thing I'd say is I'm not comfortable having the government referee that dispute, right? Because you talked about the FCC, and I respect the people at the Trump FCC. I don't respect the people Kamala Harris would appoint to her FCC and having them make that decision a few years down the road.
Especially with the FCC, then ultimately that would go to the courts, right? And I mean, I kind of get what you're saying, but if ultimately we're in a society where we can't trust the court system at all, then we have bigger problems than big tech.
That's right. A fair point. Let's shift gears. I want to ask you about one of the topics you write about a lot for EV Magazine, feminism, right? So first, can you kind of describe the state of modern feminism as you see it?
So I think the issue with modern feminism that a lot of people on the left, on the right, men and women see is that it's no longer really about gender equality. It's more about gender supremacy almost. And what I think for a lot of people may be just this desire to have women and men live equally and fairly together. For other activists, who I think are an increasingly vocal number of people, it's about shaming men for being men. It's about trying to elevate women over men. It's about trying to do things like also dismantle the nuclear family, promote promiscuity and things like that, incorporate just general Marxist ideas into mainstream society. So, I mean, I think if we compare mainstream current feminism to what a lot of people might think of feminism very broadly, there's a lot of differences. It's a lot more insidious. And we also have the whole intersectional element, which is very confusing. And I think overall, it's become a net negative for society.
So I agree with your critique pretty much of modern feminism. It's become like a left-wing movement. Like the Women's March is not about women. It's about left-wing policy agenda. You go there and you see anti-Trump, gun control, pro-abortion signs all over the place. I think, though, the thing that interests me is some conservatives, at least here in kind of like in the space that I work in, kind of revert to the opposite mean. They skew and they kind of go back to this. There's basically like old-fashioned style, like sex stereotypes, gender norms. I almost believe in what I would call like a conservative feminism, right? Not pro-choice, not about abortion, not about left-wing politics, but about like women can be equal to men, if not the same, but equal, right? Women should be in politics if they want to be. They should have careers, right? They should speak out. They shouldn't defer to their husbands necessarily. Like, so, and that's kind of articulated by some of the young right of center women that I follow, that I think of, you know, the kind of people that prop up Nikki Haley as an icon of what a conservative, powerful woman can be, or even Amy Coney Barrett, right? She's a family woman, but she's also going to be a Supreme Court justice and has mm-hmm. had an amazing career. So I guess what I'm trying to ask is, do you think there's some feminist principles that can be reconciled with conservatism?
Well, I guess, and I would hesitate to call them feminist principles. I believe that under the law, there absolutely should be equality between men and women. You know, I'm not in support of the law looking at your genitals and saying, okay, you can do this and you can't do this, et cetera, et cetera. I also believe that we need a fair amount of autonomy in society. And I think that, you know, society functions best when people are able to pursue their best interests and things like that. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of Amy Coney Barrett, so I don't have any issue there. But I would also hesitate to say that more women in politics is a sign of progress in society by any means. That's just not something that I believe. I don't think that politics is inherently better or more fair or more representative because women are the people who are making laws. That doesn't mean that if I wouldn't support an individual woman who wants to go into politics, you absolutely can. But I guess my main concern just in general would be how this affects the family. Yeah.
And when you say how this affects the family, what do you mean?
I mean, it's very clear that when women spend more time out of the home, there are consequences to things like fertility rates in different countries. You know, we have entire generations of children right now who are being raised by daycare systems, which is, I mean, it's not a good thing for the mothers. It's not a good thing for the children either. You know, I think if we also look at the way that the economy is functioning right now, you have a crazy amount of single mothers who understandably are unable to support children because, I mean, what are you supposed to do? It's like a catch-22. You have to go to work, but you can't afford to leave your kid at home, but you can't afford to, you know, pay childcare unless you go to work. So it's just a really uncomfortable situation. And I believe a lot of why we find ourselves as societies in these situations is because of feminism. So, you know, definitely believe women should have all the rights as men, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not going to pretend that men and women are the same or that there's no societal consequences to women, you know, by and large being shoved into the workforce and the family taking a backseat is what, like we see right now in so many Western countries.
Right. And you brought up an interesting point because you've described yourself, I think, and tell me if this isn't right, but as a Christian nationalist.
Right.
What does that mean?
A Christian who is also a nationalist. Christian nationalist. And I think a lot of people look at the term nationalism and they think it's a terrible fascist ideology, which is news to me. And I think most political scientists worldwide, a nationalism is just simply an exaltation of, you know, the nation and the idea that you need to have a sense of connection with the people who, you know, are your fellow citizens. And I think that's very important. And the reason why I add Christian to that descriptor is because I think it's the backbone of, you know, how I would view a moral and just society. We have this growth of humanism and communism and secularism across the planet, you know, not just Canada, not just the US. We see it everywhere. And I think as that's increased, we've seen a bigger and bigger reliance on government. And Dennis Prager says it amazingly well when he says that a small government can only function when you have a big God. And I believe that's also what the founding fathers thought. And that is a huge part of how I view society. And I think that what a lot of people are turning to the government to solve could much more easily be solved on a community level and on a spiritual level. And so, you know, the Christian part of that descriptor is also a way of saying that politics shouldn't be everything. You know, definitely it's important, but if you have a sick society on the moral, spiritual level, you can have the best government in the world. It's not going to make things better.
So let's tackle that in two separate things. I want to talk a little bit about faith and then a little bit about nationalism in a minute. But to talk about the Christianity aspect of it, I think you're totally right. The founding fathers said, like, our American system of free people can only work for a religious and moral society. I guess, though, like, I really lean more towards agreeing with the moral part, because I guess what I would say is, like, I'm agnostic.
Morality.
I guess you could say all morality stems back to some sort of religion, but I guess the question is, couldn't you have moral people who are based in community who aren't necessarily overly religious? Couldn't you still have those things without everyone being a Christian?
Well, I don't think everyone needs to be a Christian for sure. And I'm not suggesting some sort of like religious test for citizenship or anything like that. But I guess my counter to that would be, where is this mythical society? Like, where has it, or when has it ever existed? And, you know, a lot of people might say, like, yeah, morals, any type of morality is based on, you know, religious principles. I mean, to me, it's not just religious principles. I'm talking specifically about Christianity, right? Because you have societies based on religious principles that I very strongly disagree with, and I wouldn't support something like Sharia law or anything like that.
Yeah, neither would I, let me tell you.
Yeah, no, for sure. So when I say that, I do think that this would work best with a Christian backbone. It's not to say that everybody needs to be Christian, but I think, you know, when we see the continual rejection and, I guess, mockery of Christian ideals like we are seeing now, we see how, I guess, you know, the rate of single motherhood has gone up, right? And with that comes child poverty. With that comes broken homes, increase in things like inner city crime, teen pregnancy. Like, there are actual widespread ramifications for this. So this isn't just based on an ideological level. There's also a practical implication as well. And I don't foresee a libertarian, secular society of, like, moral people ever happening. I can't imagine what the backbone of that would be.
I guess that's not exactly how I see it, right? What I envision as the ideal future of America is not a religious America or a non-religious America. It's a pluralist America, right? Where I and my boyfriend can live and do our thing and not be religious and have full rights under the government, but yet also we're not going to infringe on our Christian neighbor down the street, right? He's going to have full rights. Nobody's going to force him to bake a cake or violate his church or tell him what he can and can't do. And we all kind of peacefully coexist with that, even though we don't have shared values in terms of religion. We might have shared political values, shared American values. But are you seeing that as kind of problematic, or do you think that's also feasible?
Well, I think it's feasible to a point, right? I think it's perfectly, like, there are atheists in Western countries who are very respectful of religious people. But I think the more different types of values you have in the society, the more likely there is for conflict. And we're seeing that right now. So like I said, I don't want some sort of religious test where everybody needs to be Christian and they're going to monitor your church attendance or anything like that. But I think, you know, if we live in a society, the more and more differences we have, the harder it is to form a cohesive whole, right? And I, for example, let's take the issue of race. I am someone who firmly believes that people of different races can live in the same country and be friends and neighbors and fellow citizens, and that can work. But if we take, for example, on the other hand, the left wing's idea of a perfect nation where people are of different cultural backgrounds, religious backgrounds, racial backgrounds, you know, you chip away at a common identity enough and eventually you're left with nothing, absolutely nothing to actually bind you together as a people. And I think, like in Canada, for example, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called Canadians, like, said there's no national Canadian identity. Canada is a post-national state. Well, then what's the point then of that? That's not a nation anymore. That's just like a collection of what, city states or different neighborhoods and loose affiliation. That's not what I want. And I don't think that's what it means to be Canadian. So when we talk about religious identity across a nation, it's not to say that everyone needs to share the exact same ones, but there needs to be a common respect. And I think, you know, the more cohesion there, the better. So I would shy away from any type of pluralism by and large.
So I guess what I see as the mechanism that preserves people's ability to live side by side, even when they have different values and be under one common tent, is the classical liberal pillars of the society. Things like the First Amendment, things like respect for freedom of religion.
how different can people be if you're assuming that they can coexist under the classical liberal tent, right? Because already in America and Canada and the UK and Australia, we see people who are outright rejecting those ideas. We see them rejecting those ideas on the left. We see people rejecting those ideas, you know, hardcore on the right as well, if you get into people who are actually alt-right. So it's those types of differences that I'm saying cannot exist. And I think those types of differences are more and more likely when you introduce that pluralism into society consciously.
So I think the cause of those is centralized power in a federal government. So I think if you had a federalized system, part of the reason there's this intense fight to force your will on others from the left and the alt-right, like you said, is because we have this winner-takes-all mentality with this expansive federal government. But if you had a decentralized system where California got to be California and could make its own abortion rules, and Texas could make its own abortion rules, right? And the federal government wasn't dictating for all 50 states, then there wouldn't be this same push to force your values onto others, no? I mean, don't you think we could exist in a pluralistic society like that?
I disagree, because let's take the issue of abortion, right? You know, there are states that have abortion up until birth, maybe even a little bit after birth. But we still see that there is this huge cry from the left over any discussion about overturning Roe versus Wade. And I would love to think that they're just ignorant about Roe versus Wade and what it means, right? It wouldn't outlaw abortion. It would just relegate the issue back to the states. But still, we see people in California crying over the idea of Roe versus Wade overturned. Why? It's not going to change California's laws about abortion. But it's there are people out there who they actually care. It's not just enough for them to have their own laws in their own state or to be able to do whatever they want to do. They want to explicitly be able to control what you do. And I'm saying with people like that, you can't have people like that and expect to upkeep a small government society, because small government is, I guess, the antithesis of what they are looking for. And even if that's not what you want, they will take it upon themselves to inflict their will upon what you're doing day to day. And I have this conversation with libertarians a lot, you know, for example, with the issue of immigration. They might say like, well, I don't believe in borders, so let's just have an open society. And it's like, okay, well, you're a libertarian. We live in countries where people can vote, right? So you can say that, yeah, I'm not going to try to dictate what you do all you want, but that doesn't mean that the other people in the country are going to abide by that same set of rules. So you're actually putting yourself at a disadvantage if you kind of take this like, oh, hands-off approach when the other person isn't willing to do the same.
Well, so let's talk about immigration, because that's a really interesting topic where we do diverge significantly, I think, and I want to flesh that out. So I'm not a supporter of open borders. I support border security, but my general view is that I focus on economics, so I'm an economics guy, but I know you want to talk about the cultural aspect of it, so we'll get into that as well.
I want to talk about the economics of immigration as well.
I will say that from all the studies and research and surveys of economists that I'm plugged into, immigration is a net good for the American economy, right?
Net good for the American people, right? A lot of times when we look at immigration studies, they're going to compare something like, oh, let's see the overall change on GDP or something like that. But what they're actually not showing you is that when immigrants come in and it's simple supply and demand. A lot of them are competing for low skill, low earning jobs, right? And what we see is that especially among, for example, African-American communities, there are entire communities who have been kind of decimated and had their wages cut by having to compete with immigrants who are pouring in and competing for the same jobs that they are. If we also talk about something like wage stagnation.
Well, let's do that one at a time. Okay. So to talk about the jobs angle, I think it's actually too simplistic to look at it with a simple supply and demand model, because you're not just injecting another body into the system, right, in terms of supply and demand. You're actually expanding the productive capabilities of the entire nation, right? So like the productive possibilities frontier has expanded. So it's almost as if that would cause a demand shift as well as a supply shift. So well, there's more going on there.
Anyone who might say that, oh yes, well, they're coming and they're having jobs, but it's okay because they're going to inject that money back into the economy. I think you're also forgetting about the issue of remittances, right? Because remittances from the United States to places in South America is a huge industry, right? So it's not accurate in the current economy to say that, you know, any of the productivity and any of the wealth and capital they're creating is staying in the economy.
Well, a lot of it is. Not true. Even if some is getting sent out. I mean, they're still buying groceries. They're still buying a car. They're still paying rent. Like, they're still injecting a lot of that around them.
Well, actually, the whole thing with rent, that's just another issue where I have to say that the current number of immigrants being taken in is unsustainable, because we see property prices have also really increased in places that are high density where immigrants tend to flock toward. And actually, my fiance and I have talked about this quite a bit. We are the belief that if you are going to have immigrants come in, you should also have to, as an immigrant, and I say this as someone who has been an immigrant, live in designated areas, right? Because right now what we see in the UK, Canada, US, you name it, is that there are immigrant hubs, centers where all the immigrants want to go. And right now people are being, who are, you know, born there, regardless of the race that they are, they're being priced out of the market for housing and things like that. Costs of living are increasing and increasing. I think if we were, as a government, to say, okay, you know, we can accept this many immigrants, but we're going to spread them out for at least, like, let's say 3 years, in order to not overwhelm these urban centers and also to encourage assimilation, I think that would actually alleviate a lot of the problems with immigration that people like me talk about.
So we agree there, because I look at the map of the United States and I say, like I said earlier, what's right for Utah isn't necessarily right for Los Angeles. Right. And so you have like 30 states that are declining in overall population. So I'd be perfectly fine with an immigration system that gave state-specific or area-specific visas to areas to where they need more people, where right. they need more workers. So we would agree on that. Let's talk about the issue of wages, because what you're the idea that immigrants are a net negative to American workers' wages is not something
American workers, specifically low-skilled workers.
Right. So, yeah, you do have to make that distinction, because right. the studies make that distinction. But for every American that comes in, I was just looking at a study today, for every immigrant that comes in, 1.2 jobs is created in the overall economy. And for everybody except male workers who don't have a high school degree, the wages are equal or greater, right? It's really a small group.
When you say something like for every immigrant that comes in, I think that's a little bit of a dishonest thing to do that these studies do, because then you're comparing people like H-1B holders, like my brother, to someone who is someone who came in with chain migration with absolutely no skills or qualifications at all, right? So that's a very different thing. Someone on an H-1B visa is someone who actually has to have a job offer and a company willing to sponsor them, versus someone who has come in with perhaps no qualifications at all based on a familial relationship. And I think it's the Heritage Foundation has actually done the study that for every immigrant without a high school degree that comes in, they actually, over the course of their lifetime, cost American taxpayers over $100,000. So, you know, I'm someone who is very much in favor of a merit-based points
high skill
system. Yeah, high skilled. And, you know, for the longest time, that is what places like Canada used to have before Trudeau. And we actually had an immigration system where the average immigrant coming to Canada was more educated than the native population, which is, I think, exactly what you want, because you can ensure that the people who are coming over are actually people who are going to be job creators. Like you said, like you mentioned, absolutely is the case. It's not a question of like all immigration bad or anything like that. But like I said, we're talking about the mass influx of low-skilled workers. That is a very different thing than someone who is coming in who is a doctor. And for example, Canada has a shortage of doctors. That's something very different.
Well, this is
interesting, and I'm not afraid to make that distinction.
No, it's a good distinction, because right now conservatives kind of in America, at least, oppose immigration overall, right? Legal immigration, including high skill. When you look at the Trump administration, they're slashing H-1B visas. They're cutting skilled immigration. And I would agree with you that if we want to focus on bringing in just more skilled immigrants, there's a backlog of, when you look at immigrants from India that come here with coding degrees or medical degrees, right? They are so successful. They do so well. And also, there are certain places that have more compatible values. And we can talk about the cultural piece of it. I would say there's a wait list miles long for some of these countries for skilled people to come in. And so I'm all about focusing on that and opening that up. But some people in the conservatives space don't make any distinction between those two groups of immigrants.
Right. And I think the reason why there are people who don't make that distinction is because for so long, the immigration system has been handled so poorly. They don't see that distinction being made, right? They go to places where no one speaks English and things like that. And that in their mind is what immigration is, which, like you said, is not the case. So, and I think that has affected a lot of how people view immigration. And I'm someone who very strongly believes that I think the immigration system and the needs of the economy need to work hand in hand, right? So I think there needs to be, people who are monitoring, let's see, like, what is the, labor shortage or surplus looking like in this different sector? And then the number of visas available needs to be able to reflect that. Because like I said, in Canada, we have a shortage of doctors. I would be happy to bring over more doctors. There are other industries where there's too many. We have too many graphic designers. Actually, there are native graphic designers who aren't able to find jobs. We can probably ease on importing those. It needs to be a system that works holistically.
No, I agree with you, right? For example, before COVID, because obviously that threw a lump in thing, but the economy under President Trump was very strong. Mm-hmm. And you actually, I forget the exact statistic. I used to cite it all the time. There was like 10 million more jobs than job seekers, right? So that would have been a time to bring in people to fill those jobs. Now, when you have tens of millions of people on the unemployment rolls, I'm okay with not bringing in people, right, to fill jobs.
Because there are no jobs.
Right. So that's a very fair point to have it come and go like that. Mm-hmm. But also, like, part of the problem is, I agree with you, we should be opening the floodgates right now for trained doctors and nurses or researchers or whatever. And we're not doing that here, at least in the U.S.
I still wouldn't say opening the floodgates, because, of course, you have to look at things like the property prices of, where there are more considerations than just the economy. In Canada, even like when we did have that points based system, what we saw is that we got a lot of immigrants coming over from China and Hong Kong. And, obviously, from Hong Kong, nothing bad to say about Hong Kong people. But, there is still the reality in Vancouver now where there are entire enclaves of Chinese people who don't really speak English, who haven't made the effort to assimilate because, there's enough of them there. They can form their own communities. That's not what you want either, even if the economy says it's a good thing. But, if, like you and I were saying, we had a system in place where you could actually dictate where people who are new arrivals can go, we could spread out the strain on, real estate and things like that. We could ensure assimilation. That would be a different story.
No, and that's a good point. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I think the economics of immigration are a different story from the cultural side of immigration. They're basically two different arguments. But I think that in general, there are a lot of groups of immigrants that share American values and that end up being great additions. When you look at entrepreneurship, or you look at even them, if you want to look at it, people care about political considerations. Let in more Cuban Americans. They vote Republican all day. So I guess I'm saying I don't view that as the big hurdle to embracing legal immigration that some conservatives do. And maybe you do. So maybe you could talk about that.
Well, I mean, with immigration, I'm always very hesitant to say immigration as just like a broad brush, whatever, no different considerations or anything like that. Like you said, I think there are different immigrant groups who are more or less culturally similar to, American, Canadian, whatever, Western culture in general. That's absolutely true. And, as someone who's lived in the UK and in Europe, I think there are some real tensions there that are arising from immigrant groups who are coming in, en masse, really, who maybe don't have similar cultural values. And in Quebec, I think it is, they're actually wanting to implement a cultural, a questionnaire as a component of the immigration system. And I know there are people who say, like, what does it even mean to have Western values? What values does everyone in America say? Well, if we're going to say something like, there shouldn't be no blasphemy laws, men and women should have equal rights under the law, it's not okay to stone homosexuals, those are pretty broad brush Western values that I know it may be shocking to a lot of us who've grown up in the West, but no, not everybody shares. And I don't think it's too much to ask that someone who comes over wants to live in those same values. And, there are tons of immigrants who wouldn't even hesitate to say, of course. And there are also immigrants from countries who don't think that. And their sole reason for wanting to come here is that we do think that. And I don't think those people specifically are helped if we import all of the people that they're also running away from. And, unfortunately, in Canada and in the UK, there have been instances of honor killings and things like that. And I think we do a huge disservice to those immigrant populations when we don't take a strong enough stand against, the type of self-policing that sometimes happens.
Well, and I'm glad we can have this conversation, because you even mentioning culture would have some people just scream racist, right? And it's not racist, right? It's a very valid concern to point out. And I feel this as somebody who like I'm gay, my boyfriend and I walk around holding hands. You poll people in some Muslim countries in the Middle East, and like 8 in 10 support executing gays, like you said. Yeah. So I'm not offended by the argument that we should consider cultural values in our immigration system. It's a fair one. But I would point out the fact that, like you said, just individuals in any country aren't necessarily in sync with that country's broad swath. So I would never say like no people from Saudi Arabia, but I think it'd be perfectly fair to say you must repudiate Sharia law to come to America.
You mentioned like no people from Saudi Arabia. I just want to, because a lot of people think that that is something that President Trump has done with what they call the Muslim ban, which isn't a Muslim ban. But again, as someone who's kind of gone through the immigration system, I do want to explain that one of the reasons why sometimes you do have to do country-specific bans is that the immigration application process, it's actually up to the immigrant to go to their own local police force and government and collect any criminal record files or anything like that to hand to the United States government. So for example, like if I'm a Canadian, I need to have a criminal background check done in my own country. For some countries that unfortunately have failed states or unstable governments, that type of cooperation between the United States and the local government is not possible. And so when the U.S. government is not able to confirm, you know, the identity, the criminal record or whatever of a prospective immigrant, that does cause problems within the immigration system. But that should not be conflated as saying, you know, no one from this country, because everyone in this country is bad, right? There's a huge difference between saying your government system right now, sadly, is unreliable versus, you know, no Muslims, no Saudis or something like that.
So yeah, now I want to ask you about the fun part that I ask every guest that comes on the show. So I've had Steve Forbes the other day was telling me how he likes peanut butter and bacon sandwiches. Blair White was on here a couple of weeks ago talking about how she likes, ramen, and she just eats it like a rice cake. So Lauren, tell my listeners what your grossest or most controversial food take is.
Coming from Hong Kong, I do eat quite a number of things that I know a lot of people aren't comfortable with. I eat chicken feet, I eat jellyfish, I eat pigeon, and I think those are all great. But probably, in my opinion, my most controversial food take is that I eat pancakes plain. Like, I don't use butter, I don't use syrup, I eat them plain.
That's so dry.
Not if it's a good pancake. Right? It's like chicken. You shouldn't need gravy on chicken. If chicken is cooked properly, it can stand up on its own. And I feel the same way about pancakes.
Well, if steak is cooked properly, then it's well done and you dip it in ketchup.
No. If you go to a nice restaurant, you say what you just said, they'll kick you out.
My boyfriend doesn't let me order my steak the way I want it when we go out to eat because he doesn't want to be embarrassed.
He's right to do so.
All right. Well, thank you, Lauren. And thanks everybody for tuning into the show again. We really appreciate it. If you like the show so far, make sure that you're subscribed on iTunes, Spotify, and YouTube. And be sure to leave us a 5-star rating and review too, if you can. That's it for this week, and we'll talk to you all next weekend.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.